This is the Boundless Pursuit Podcast, a show highlighting the purity of the experience without limitation. Each week, we'll bring anglers as diverse as the fish they chase, whether it be from your backyard or your bucket list. Freshwater, saltwater, conventional gear, or fly, we're bringing stories and perspectives from fishermen from all walks of life, from across the country and globe. In the digital age, authentic communication and networking is critical, and I'd love to hear from you about show suggestions, potential guests, or general feedback. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com or at my website, www.boundless-pursuit.com. That's where you'll find the entire collection of written articles, podcast episodes, and media. I deeply value the feedback, ratings, reviews, and support of my listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm your host, David Graham. Now let's get on to today's episode. All right. Now, I know sometimes we have these far-fetched or far-off topics of fishing from time to time on this show, and a lot of fish that may never be in the cards for my listeners or me. But today we're doing some bass talk, smallmouth bass in particular. And I'm being joined by Caleb Corona of Regal Beagle Fly Fishing. And Caleb operates as a custom fly tire and light tackle fishing guide in the great state of Minnesota. And while Caleb does dabble in the variety of fish that Minnesota waters are so well known for, catching fish like bigmouth buffalo, lake sturgeon, pike, and trout, his bread and butter are the healthy populations of smallmouth in his local watershed. So during this conversation, we just talk about the thrills of chasing smallmouth bass on swift water floats, where you got to make every cast count. And I just love hearing people prop up and break down their home waters. This is an awesome conversation with a passionate angler, fly tire, and guide out of Minnesota. This is Caleb Corona of Regal Beagle Fly Fishing. Anyway, man, Caleb, I appreciate getting you on here. I know we just made small talk for like 25 minutes, but we didn't reveal any secrets yet that I wanted to talk about on here. But man, when I stumbled across your stuff and we connected on Instagram through mutual friend, mutual connection, Justin Hokinson, another former podcast guest. I was taken aback by the name of your guide service, your channel, Regal Beagle.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, what is, you know, there's always a significance, but I'm like, what is that comes from out of left field? You got like a beagle that's near and dear to your heart? Is it like named after a pet of yours? Did you grow up with beagles?
I didn't grow up with them, but I do have one. Yeah. Wrigley. Wrigley was the dog that kind of got me through grad school. So I have a blue tick beagle. Her name's Wrigley. She's about four in May. Regal Beagle thing was actually my wife's title. Obviously she goes on the boat with us quite a bit, so she'll hop up in the front seat and she'll kind of do this little pose where she sticks her chest way up, and my wife said she kind of looks like she's royalty the way she's sitting there. So the Regal Beagle name came from that, and the logo's drawn to try to match her. She's got the blue tick colors, so up here in Minnesota, not pretty familiar with the blue tick, but she's from around my hometown in Tennessee, so ton of blue tick down there. So she's that's the explanation for the day. It is after our dog, Wrigley, the beagle. So that's the behind the name and how she rides with us in the boat. So that's where the name came from.
I gotcha. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Oh, it's always good to have a good boat dog. I could never do that with my dogs. They're just, I love my dogs to death. They're getting up there in age. Very, very sentimental about my dogs, but I just can't. I can't bring them fishing. They're just two big boneheaded idiots that would cause me all kinds of strife out there. Probably attack other people. Crap in the boat.
She's a pretty relaxed little dog. She just kind of hangs out in the little spot underneath the front of the drift boat. You know, she's pretty comfortable wherever she is.
Now are you doing, is that like, you know, I know you do some guiding, and we're going to get into that, but we're going to get into that like right now. Is that the name of the guide service you're doing? And are you doing that full time on the side? Like, what are you doing? I don't know, for work, you know, more often.
Yeah.
Full-time.
So Regal Beagle is the company I started. So I started Regal Beagle in last year, officially in March. Growing up in Tennessee, I did some guiding, you know, here or there when I was an undergrad. So I've had done it quite a bit in the past. And It's not my full-time job. So my full-time job is I'm actually an entomologist. I work for a company here in the Minneapolis area. We work on developing new insecticides and repellents, gearing more towards the environmentally friendly route. So kind of away from the harsher chemicals, more, you know, botanically based or plant-based. So that's my full-time job. And then I just found myself taking a lot of people. I grew up smallmouth fishing on a river in Tennessee, ended up in Minnesota, and obviously knew the potential of Minnesota. Came up here, you know, spent a few years learning the fishery, sharing that with, buddies from work and things like that. And then I kind of like it when it happens organically, that you just kind of build it. Wasn't something this isn't like the full-time job that I wanted to be doing, but I love, I guess, the teaching aspect of it. I did a lot of, teaching work when I was in grad school. I did my PhD at Iowa State in entomology. While I was there, I did a lot of teaching and got to work with a lot of people on that end. And that was something I was always kind of doing growing up. So it was a really natural kind of addition to my life, at least, and have a just really passionate kind of sharing the resources we have up here and mixing that with entomology, obviously, from a fly fishing point of view, works really, really well for me and bringing in the teaching component and this ability to get people out here. We have so many people here that don't. I've lived in Minnesota for 75 years. I had a few clients last year that, they're in their 70s and lived in Minnesota, never caught a smallmouth before, never been on the Mississippi River before. We have such a lake centric thing here.
Just
being able to share these new experiences with people is really something I really appealed to me on the guide portion of it. So yeah, that's full-time job as an entomologist. And I do a lot of, evening floats, people after work, weekend trips. So not my full-time deal, but I run the guide service and then that's tie a lot of fly orders for people all over the country, kind of for anything that swims. But
yeah. Okay. Yeah. So when you just mentioned the entomology and the work with mosquitoes, my mind just went to like some crazy places. And I even let myself get a little distracted there, but like, so this is where my mind goes, but I'm thinking like, if I'm you and I go on a fishing trip, I'm going to expense that off. Like I'm doing field work. Okay. I am sampling the mosquitoes out here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
a lot of my field work tends to be in places that just so happen to have really good fishing around them. And try to time that as best as I can. So they definitely feed into each other a lot.
This is research. I'm seeing if there's a correlation between the fish populations and the mosquitoes here. Yeah. Okay.
It just so happens the mosquitoes love around the time the tarpon roll in the evenings. I can't control that.
Well, yeah, I've noticed that too. It's like they really get on you when the bite is hot and you're trying to focus on catching them. Like that's when they come after you. You know what it is? I think it's because your blood pressure gets higher. You know what I mean? You start sweating a little bit more. You get nervous. That's when the blood. You know what I mean? That's when it gets real sweet. That's when they want to attack you. Oh, man. See, that's a field of work I need to get into. I got a lot of questions. But so most of your fishing, though, again, I told you, I was like, I'll keep this conversation corralled. You might be the one corralling me, but
let's do it.
Most of the fishing and what you're doing guide wise, is centered around from what I saw in your pictures, some really nice looking smallmouth bass. And that always throws me for a loop because when I think bass fishing as a guide or something that you're going to, you're providing a service. I think that seems like there's got to be a lot of it's like high competition. You know what I mean? It's such a sought after fish. There's a lot of demand around it. So then it's like, when you think of a fish like that and paying money to go do it, and you have different options. I mean, you can catch a smallmouth bass in a lot of different places. So for me, let's say if I'm the one who wants to go and do it, the fish almost takes a backseat. Like I know we're going to catch fish, but what tips the scales in favor of where you fish? Because I think, the difference makers is like the ambiance of the experience. It's the wildlife. It's the terrain. It's the scenery. Mm-hmm. It's like that, which is around you, is really more the selling point. When the fish can be caught anywhere, the difference maker is the rest of the experience. So like what does a day on your drift boat look like? I guess that's a good starting point. Like the experience as a whole, what can people expect if they jump on board with you?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I like to, it's a good selling point. Like you said, we fish the Mississippi River. not pulling any punches. It's the same river that, you know, ends up in Louisiana. Everyone's kind of familiar with it. You know, it's the river that built America. So, you know, in a way, that's really cool for people. You know, they want to say, oh, I fished on the Mississippi. So that's a really cool thing. But just being able to show, you know, someone that's never been up here the difference. I mean, if you're familiar with it, you know, down south, it gets real wide, gets real muddy. The stretch we're fishing, you know, north of the Twin Cities area a little bit, you know, it's not what you typically think of, I guess. You know, most of the warm water rivers I grew up with in the south, a lot of people travel up here from the south. You don't get many clear water opportunities, you know, in the area that I am. You're fishing for smallmouth, you know, Tennessee, Virginia. It's a lot more murkier stuff. There's not a whole lot of sight fishing opportunities. So the places we're fishing are really clear. So we're, you know, up above the cities. So we're kind of in that wilder scenic part of it, above most, the majority of the dams on the Mississippi. So we're up, you know, between St. Cloud and the cities. Kind of that stretch is where I focus the majority of my fishing. So we're fishing really clear water. It's a bigger river, so it's pretty wide, but we fish a lot of shallow stuff. So it's a really visual fishery. So you're, no matter if you're, and I do, obviously the fly fishing is the name of the company, but you know, I do a lot of conventional fishing too with people. I do conventional fishing myself. I have clients that conventional fish, but you know, it's a lot more visual than I think you could compare it to most other smallmouth fisheries that I've gotten lucky enough to experience. You know, the majority of fish, if you're throwing a streamer, you're hitting the bank with it, stripping it off, or we're targeting, you know, I'll call it offshore structure, but stuff that's not directly on the bank. You're watching the fly swim. You're watching the fish chase it down. And I like to tell people too, you know, it's a lot of people know about the Mississippi. It's not a secret, but the fish act like fish are supposed to. It's how I try to talk it to people. You don't see a whole lot of hesitation. I mean, they'll munch a streamer pretty good for you, and you get to see all of it. And obviously we're Minnesota, we're north of the cities. It's pretty, you know, rural areas for the most part. It's crazy to see how quickly you lose, you know, any remnants of a city up here. People here, I'm based in Minneapolis. You think about the urban, you know, it's the center. It's 3-4 million people, whatever it is at the current time. And, you know, if we see another boat out there, I'm shocked in the days that we're out there for the most part. You know, we do a lot of evening trips, you know, fish from, you know, 5 to dark. We do a lot of that time period fishing, and you do run into a lot of people. You don't run into a lot of people, I'm sorry, out there. So it's the serenity close stuff. Such a larger city. You're fishing clear water. Like you said, the quality of the fish here, something that I'm fished a lot of places, and I don't know that there's a quality of fish that you can catch that's this, you know, a lot of big fish. We're lucky enough to benefit from a ton of conservation efforts that have been put into this river. A lot of special regulations that, you know, I've gotten lucky enough to be good friends with some of the guys that were responsible for that, you know, back in the 80s, even, that kind of made this river what it is. So, you know, a typical day, you're seeing, you know, a ton of fish, you're seeing big fish. It's a visual experience, you know, for people that are coming from more urban areas. You know, bald eagles up here, not a rare thing. You know, I fish with a lot of people, but that blows your mind. And after, you know, after a summer out here, you almost get a little bit desensitized to it. You see that stuff all the time. And we had a few golden eagles up here this year.
That's neat. Okay.
Yeah, we see, you know, obviously a ton of smallmouth, and that's what I tailor most things to. That's what people want to come up here and do. But, you know, you get a lot of bycatch out here, and we'll talk about, you know, some of the bigger natives later. But, you know, we get a lot of the smallmouth. You know, you see pike. I've run ins with muskies, and it is a really good, it's a really good opportunity for people that, you know, you get a lot of seasoned anglers that say you want to come up here and I want my 6-pounder. That's the goal. That's all I care about. But then it's just a really good place to learn for me. It's a lot of, you know, high access. There's a lot of fish. I don't know what the per mileage data works out to now, but it's a lot. So it's a really good chance to, if you have a beginner, if you've always wanted to get into fly fishing, you get some really good action there. And it also, I think of, you know, the drift boat way as a different kind of experience. I can take people and show them how many people see me driving on the highway up here, stop me at a red light, you know, ask me what kind of boat is that? You know, it's a very, you know, out west, it's super common. Everyone and their brother's got a drift boat in Montana and Wyoming and that area. But, you know, and it's definitely growing a bit here, but it's just it's an experience that, you know, there's no motor. I don't run a motor on mine at all. There's no trolling motor. It's all based on float fishing. So putting in one spot, taking out another, you're seeing, you know, 10 to 15 miles of, you know, beautiful wilderness every day. It's quiet. There's no motor going on. So, I mean, all these animals you're seeing, we had foxes and beavers almost jump in the boat a few times. You're creeping down a bank and they don't know you're there because it's so quiet. And just really good. It's just a really good experience in my mind, and something not a lot of people have seen, especially here in the Midwest, the jerk boat idea.
I think that element of it makes it sound more, it's like more adventurous too, but like it's the nature of the drift. Is this a pretty swift moving? I mean, I'm sure you work different rivers, but like typically are you in like a scenario where, I don't know, you're working the backside of a certain rocks, like they got one shot at it because you're moving, or are you, or do you have the ability with that boat to position yourself and make numerous casts at the same fish? Is it like, you know, you got to position? Like, I feel like you would, are you like having to sit there and like maneuver the boat and control the boat the entire time and like set them up for the highest level of success? And are you like calling the shots like, oh, cast over there, or just kind of giving them free rein to cast wherever they want?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, I mean, we, depending on the time of year, obviously we're up north, ton of snowfall, except for this year, I guess. We'll see what this spring looks like. But typically in the spring, you know, everyone's familiar with rivers by like how you read a CFS number. And I know it means something different to everybody else, but you know, our typical season, we're at like 8,000 CFS, which is pretty good flow for the Mississippi where we are. The springtime when we dumped in, so we still have season here. I know a lot of different states have different seasons. I know Michigan, I think, got rid of theirs for smallmouth, for you can kind of open fish all year round. So ours opens around the middle of May, which also tends to be about the same time the snow melts up north. Like Duluth area in Canada. So I mean, we put in May for our first trip this year at like 35,000 CFS when you're used to 8,000. So it's, it bucks pretty good early in the year. And you know, that's, we do have the capability to spot, like in a normal flow scenario. I mean, there's a, you know, the anchor line runs to the boat, drops out the back with drift boats. So you're able to anchor in pretty swift water.
Okay.
That, something that strong is, I wouldn't advise. I'll give it that way. But then, so that can be a problem, but depends on the style of fishing too. You know, popper fishing is a pretty slow, you know, you're fishing a lot more structure. You're looking for your down trees. I mean, the same stuff everyone else is fishing in terms of structure. But the thing that, you know, we have here is obviously smallmouth is such a current-based fish. We have a big river, lots of rocks. So, I mean, there are definitely chances. I mean, a few times this year, kind of the phrase I'll tell people, my friends that fish, I'll always tell, we'll be falling down. I'll tell people, and I'll paint that rock. And usually, you know, if you get a rock in pretty swift current, that's the one break they can get in that 50-yard section. For something like that, you know, I can back row for a bit and kind of hold a spot. And a lot of people, you can get multiple casts of the same structure, you know, on a grass flat or something. If we see a fish cruising, you can usually get multiple shots at it. I can slow it down enough. And if it's somewhere that's, you know, like a wintering hole, like later in the year, you know, October through December, you know, you'll spend a half an hour in one spot and we'll just put an anchor down and pick those holes apart. But it's pretty adaptable to the style. You know, I fish a lot of streamer anglers that want to come up here and do it. Then, you know, you're just kind of a slow roll the whole way down, hitting targets as you go. If you got a conventional guy that's fishing something like tube jigs or Ned rigs, I've got the ability to anchor it down, you know, pretty quickly, you know, pick a hole apart that way. So it's pretty adaptable to the style of fishing you're doing. I think it's a perfect, you know, boat for what, how I like to do it and how the experience I like to show people. So I think it works really well for me.
What kind of boat is it?
Yeah, it's a Clackacraft low profile. So obviously made out west, 16 feet, it's fiberglass.
Okay.
The tagline is fear no rock. I think that's the motto for Clackacraft. There's a few that I've proved that. So yeah, it's, you know, this year, as with most of the Midwest, we had a pretty big drought this year. Got super low water. I mean, to the point where a few times we're walking boats up here, and we usually draft, and just to give you an idea, jet boats, I think, can get like 6 or 8 inches of water. I need about 3 or 4
inches. Wow, okay.
I'm a big dude, and that's a loaded boat, and we can float, you know, 3-4 inches of water. And there were times this year when we didn't have that. So, you know, there's quite a bit of low water fishing this year. It changes the game up a little bit. But drift boat's a great tool for up here, I think. And it's there's nothing I've seen yet that's worried me about it. They've got some, you know, give built into the floor. So if you hit a rock, it'll actually flex up on you. So it's built to take a really good hit, and good thing for that after this year.
Yeah. That's how you just keep the client awake. Meant to do that.
Just checking.
Well, the people that contact you and make inquiries, are you just getting like everything in between, like from the total novice to somebody who travels all over the country looking for smallmouth bass? I mean, like, what are most of the people's, you know, expectations? Or, you know, I imagine you're giving them the expectations, but your typical client, is there a rhyme or reason behind them, or are you getting a little bit of everything from complete beginners to seasoned veterans?
Yeah. I've gotten a few that I would say are like kind of the season, like I was kind of liking it to hunting, but like, you know, a few people come up here on like the trophy hunting missions. I fished everywhere. I want my 6 pounder. You know, those are few and far between of that kind of request that I see up here. We get a lot of, you know, I mean, we're in Minnesota. Obviously, it's a really good warm water, but we're close to the driftless area. You know, the driftless trout streams, there's some smallmouth down there too. But we get a lot of people that have spent a lot of time trout fishing. You know, a lot of people that have fly fished, you know, their lives and targeted strictly trout fishing, and they want to, you know, give the warm water thing a go. I get people that are coming up from, they just want to do the spin rod fishing stuff. They just want to catch a bunch of fish in a day. I would say, you know, the average person I deal with is someone that's, you know, has some experience in it, may not have done a whole lot on the warm water scene yet. Someone that's done a lot of trout fishing and, the, you know, heard smallmouth fight hard and they hit top waters and then smash streamers and want to try it out. So, I mean, I don't, and then we get some, you know, absolute beginners. I get some people this year that had wanted to float a river. You know, that's it. They've fished lakes their whole lives. They've heard the Mississippi's beautiful and the, you know, that stretch, and they just want to be out there and experience the river. So, I mean, I get people that fishing's the, you know, the secondary goal for the day, and they want to, I get people that want to, you know, I had one group that wanted to get out and just learn how to read water. So it's a float there. They were going to go back to wherever they were from, somewhere out west. And
that's pretty neat.
What kind of holding water do you want to do? If you fish this kind of structure, are the fish going to be set up upstream of this hydraulic downstream? So I've got a little bit of everything, but I would say that, you know, the least thing would probably be the people that want to come up and say, like, I've done this forever. I want to catch one big one. You know, let's catch the one big one. That's probably the lesser represented group that I've gotten. I know people do get that, and I've gotten a couple like that, but a lot more just people wanting the experience, I would say. And I've read a lot about smallmouth and want to try it out. So that's my average person, I would say. Someone that's done fly fishing and wants a little bit of a change of scenery from trout, or wants to just get out and experience the rivers. Kind of the clientele I work with the most.
I would think that'd be the ideal client too, like the student or the one that's, you know, open-minded people. But you know, when they show up, are they bringing their own gear? Are you supplying it a little bit? Like, if they show up with a bunch of giant swim baits, you know, what are the fish they're eating? You know what I mean? Like, what's their main diet in your river system? Because I guess you're probably trying to mimic that.
Yeah. So we get, it's a big river, obviously, and it's a really long river. So, you know, seasonally, it obviously changes as everyone else does. That big swim bait thing, you know, it's definitely a viable option up here. You know, the big streamers and things like that, kind of early in the year when the water's still high, when it's got some color to it from the snowfall, we'll fish some bigger stuff. Then once our water drops down a bit, it's, you know, the minnows are always there. You've always got bait fish. You know, we've had a lot of instances up here, and I've talked with people about this, and it's, I've never really heard that being a thing. You know, we have such a productive system, and we've had such a great last few years of, you know, spawning habitat. Water levels have been really good for good survival of those classes. We just have so many little fish, you know, smallmouth in the 2 to 4 inch range that, you know, you'll catch a 21 inch fish, put it in the net, and you know, get your pictures, whatever you're going to do with it. And the boat's got, you know, little baby juvenile smallmouth spit up in it. So we see a little bit of everything. I mean, from bait fish to crawdads, and, you know, that's a big one. We have a really cool terrestrial bite up here too. And again, I would speak of things in fly fishing, but, you know, there's ways to cover it with spin fishing too. We have a huge population, like damselflies and dragonflies.
Okay.
Dragonflies tend to go first, and then kind of all summer, we have a really, really good population of damsels. It's a really good topwater river for that. We can talk about flies too if you want, but we fish for a bunch of different topwaters things. We throw a lot of poppers. My favorite flies up here, like the wiggle minnows. So just bait fish impersonate or bait fish imitations, a lot of topwaters. And my personal favorites, the streamers. And then obviously you got your crawdads and your tube jigs, Ned rigs, so your bottom baits. I mean, the forage isn't that much different up here than it would be on most rivers across the country. Just from what I can see, it's just a lot more of it. You know, some of the damselfly hatches you get, I mean, there'll be eddies full of damsels and just fish cruising through there, picking them off one by one. And, you know, you can't walk through a riffle without scaring a bunch of crawdads. It's just a really productive system. And, you know, for that, you know, I think that's what really lends the river so well to just a variety of different presentations you can do. You know, some places tend to be it's a topwater river, you know, and that's not the case with anything up here. You know, you can kind of pick your poison, and that's the really cool thing to work with a lot of people that have some experience or they want to, you know, I fished two jigs and Ned rigs for the last 3 years. I'd really like to learn some topwater stuff, and it's a really good ground to learn, you know, all these different techniques, because there's so many options available to fish kind of pretty much all year. I mean, even up into now. So it's a bait fish, crawdads are the two big ones. Probably everyone says that if you ask that question. But then we get this really cool terrestrial bite with just a ton of insect life too. So that might set us apart a little bit. Just so much more topwater inclined, especially during the warmer months. It's a really cool deal up here.
That's pretty cool. What is like the high end or like the, you know, top end size fish you're looking at each year? Are you running into some pretty big monster size smallmouth?
Yeah. Yeah. And we got, I try to keep track of, you know, certain, you know, size class fish. And we got over 40 of them this year that were over 20 inches. So we're looking at least 5 pounds on some of those. Some early in the year, some late in the year. We had a few mid sixes in there. Seven's getting towards the brink. We got two fish this year that were right about seven. But state record's 8. I don't know that there's a state record fish out there. It's tough in a river to get that big.
Yeah. Well, the river fish are like the athletes though. Like, I don't know. I prefer, you know, they spend their whole life being conditioned by the current. So it's like, you know, you're a little more willing to sacrifice the size for a more dynamic fight, a more dynamic arena to fight them in.
I mean, I'd say our average fish that we get up here is, you know, somewhere in that 14 to 16 inch. There's a lot of that size in the river. And, you know, once you get into that 18 inch, I think the state classifies a trophy fish up here as, I think, 18 inch or something like that. There's a lot of 18 inch fish up here.
Yeah.
So that's people ask me, you know, what's a good fish up here? And everyone's got a different definition of it. And that kind of 18 plus is what I tend to think about when I'm saying, you know, this is a real good fish for up here. And then once you pass that 20, you know, that's had a lot of people say that's a fish of a lifetime when you catch one, you know, 20 inches. I mean, there's fish up here, 23, 24, but you know, that's a fish of a year if you get one 23, 24, but
yeah,
we get a lot kind of in that 20 to 22 inch range or kind of the upper end of the big ones. And obviously with the good spawns we've had, you get a lot in that, you know, sub 10, but your average fish is kind of at 14 to 16 inches. Just like you said, pure power up here going through so much current all year. I mean, that size will give you all you want on a, you know, 6 or 7 weight or at, you know, light action spinning around. That's a ball, man. That's tough to beat when you can get a bunch of those. And like I said, you know, numbers are usually pretty good. It's not a 3 or 4 fish trip for the most part. You got pretty consistent action for the most part, and a lot of fish in that 14 to 16 inch range. And we had a pretty good streak there this year, getting one over 20 most trips. So it's a lot of big fish. It's just I'm lucky to be on such a quality fishery, I guess.
No, that's awesome. How many people are you able to accommodate, like, on the river? Is it like a one person only type of deal, or can you take up to, two people?
I can take two. Yep. So it'll be me and then two people. So the way drift boats are laid out, I sit in the middle where the rower's bench is, where you row from. I control the anchor from the middle too. So the drift boat's got a pedal at your foot. So when I want to hit the anchor, I just kind of kick back my foot a little bit and I can drop the anchor in the back. Someone sits in the front, someone sits in the back, and both of those are kind of up higher than I am. So you're kind of, your clients or your friends, whoever's fishing with you, is up a little bit higher, give you a better vantage point there. And if it rains or something, you're not standing in water, but super comfortable for three people. So me and two more.
You get like squabbling and quarreling husband and wives, boyfriends and girlfriends, never.
Seems like being on the river takes care of most fights, in my opinion, but yeah, not anything dramatic or anything like that, but you definitely, A lot more competitions. I had quite a few like father and son trips. And those are always one of my favorites because that's something I did with my dad growing up. Yeah. So that's cool to see that stuff. But never any big dramatic fights or anything yet. But
No.
I wouldn't mind seeing it, I guess, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That'd be kind of awkward. You have to be like the mediator in between. It'd be weird. But
yeah.
I always enjoy stories from some of my guide buddies that that'll take like a husband and wife out, and the guy's wife will end up being the one catching all the fish. Even though her husband's the one who's the experienced angler, like like that side of it always entertains.
I had a trip like that this year. I had one of those. Oh yeah.
It happens to me when I go with my wife. So I'm like, there's like something behind that.
That's what I tell people, you know, I grew up close to the South Holston River, Tennessee, doing a lot of trout fishing, and the way to catch a 25 inch brown was either do it for 20 years and get really good at fly fishing or spin fishing, or be someone that's never casted before and put like a French fry on the hook. Those are the two ways to catch a giant one. So it's either you got to earn it for a long time or you don't earn it at all. It seems like if you miss that first one, it's going to be a bit.
Right. Well, that, and I tend to believe in a lot of those scenarios, maybe the spouse or the less experienced one is probably the more coachable one for you. The one that I bet that's probably a big part of it is like the people, if they'll just listen to you.
Yeah.
They'll just listen to the guide, they'll catch the fish. But,
that was something else. You know, I noticed a lot of that. You asked if, people bring their own stuff. Like, do you provide things and things like that? And that's the biggest, I guess, if people would just listen a little bit more, that might help. Yeah. I always, whenever somebody books, I send out, a little document saying like, bring your own stuff if you're comfortable with it. But, I'll provide everything that's, set up to what we're doing. And, I have spin fishing clients that'll show up with, 7.5 foot heavy action bait casters and try to throw a Ned rig or a little tube or something like that on that. And just, this is how I do it though. This is how I do it. This works.
Yeah.
You fish a spinning rod with 8 pound braid and 8 pound leader. This is going to go a lot better. This is going to go way better for you if you'll sit the bait cast for a little bit. So that's the biggest thing. Like you said, tends to be a lot of people that are a lot more experienced. That I do obviously half days and full days, and usually the first hour or so is kind of coaching them into whatever your way is going to be. And I like to start. And obviously, a lot of the places we have really good spots, kind of right off the ramp. And I like to spend the first little bit kind of dialing them into whatever the technique is that we're going to be doing or whatever they're going to learn. There's usually some spots in there that are, pretty consistent bites to a lot of people. A lot of people haven't fished a river situation yet. So I know everyone that's hearing this that takes people in rivers, you would never believe how many bites people get the first 10 minutes. Because every single rock that it drags across, nailed it right there.
Yeah.
So kind of teaching people, how to read current.
Nailed it. Yeah.
Every single time the line jumps, that doesn't always have to be a fish. And that's the biggest challenge, I think, of like a lot of people that haven't experienced it a lot, or teaching them how the river works. That's something I really like. That's my favorite part about it, seeing people the first time they do set the hook and it's not a rock and you see an 18-inch blast out of the water. That will never get old. If it does, I shouldn't be around anymore, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's such a cool thing to see people kind of experience that and get something dialed in like that in a habitat they haven't experienced before. That's what does it for me, I think, on the guide point of it. I obviously love the fish, but seeing someone see that for the first time is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would be the best part for sure. Especially, if it's the first time they've ever caught one, or they catch their personal best, or things like that. I can't imagine how rewarding that is. That's awesome. When you're doing this though, are you starting at point A and ending at point B? Like, you can't come back upriver, can you?
In the slower sections, you can back row and kind of make your ground. But 100% of the time, we're putting in at point A and taking out of point B. Yep.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's pretty.
Yeah, it's always a float. There's some little lakes and stuff around here you can mess around on.
Are there like shuttle services? How does that work?
There is. Yeah, there's a really good one here that's been around for 20 years or so. And I know, a lot of people guide out here, a lot of people that fish out here. It's kind of the established one everybody uses. And they got Monticello Shuttle. There you go, Roy. That's the guy that we use up here. We do a lot with him. And they got 6 or 7 different people. You'll meet the people at the end. So how they do it is, it's always kind of like we did before here. That shuttle drive's usually a really good opportunity to get a chance of what people are. You've talked to people obviously before, but kind of dialing in a little bit more on the day of. Usually we meet the shuttle driver at the end. So you'll meet your clients where you take out at the end of the day. They'll get in the car with you and the shuttle guy will ride up to the put in with you. Get a chance to talk things over with them, get a feel of what they're if anything's changed since you talked to him a few days before. And so you usually got about 15 or 20 minutes of a drive there to kind of talk it over with your people for the day, learn a little bit more about what they're hoping to do. And, you know, Shuttle Guy's got stories too. It's always good to hear those. And it gives people, you know, fly fishing, especially in any fishing, is the whole community aspect of it is really cool.
Yeah.
Just seeing that whole river community, how it works. And yeah, I got to drop this guy off today. I'm going to pick up Edstrom down at the next river spot. And ever just kind of, you learn where people are, learn what people have been doing. And it's just a cool thing, man. That's something that most people putting in on lakes and running around in glitter boats. It's not as much of the community factor. So people that have never seen it before, they're getting to hear from, you know, someone that's been around the river their whole life, man.
Yeah.
They're getting to hear all the, oh yeah, so-and-so's, they're catching 20s on this down. You should be fishing the next stretch down.
You know, that's an interesting take on it. I would think that those drivers or shuttle services are an invaluable source of intel. Awesome.
Yeah. And they're great.
That's funny.
Yeah. It's a cool deal. And you know, I like to tell some people, sometimes it feels like you're on like a hype crew. You know, you'll be in the boat with somebody. You picked the right guy. And I'm sure they tell everyone that, but
yeah,
it's cool. It's just part of the whole community aspect of it that I think is really, really cool.
Okay. Yeah.
And getting to share that with people too. I mean, if you meet someone at the ramp and put the boat in the water and go, it just adds to the experience of it. I think is you're seeing the community aspect really, really well. Whenever we do it this way, and yeah, it adds about 20 minutes to your day, but I mean, it's a cool thing for people to see, I think. And it's really convenient. So you finish up and, you know, people hop in their cars and head back and, you know, you head home. So it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, so like, what are some of the other players in the river? Just, you know, I always love variety a little bit. Are there other species people can get incidentally or intentionally? I mean, what's some of the other life that's in the same areas? Or do you have people who straight up say, I want to catch this other thing?
So I've never had someone come up and say, I don't want to fish for bass, period. I've not ran into that yet.
Yeah.
I've had people that will catch 30 or 40 smallmouth. And, you know, if you're doing a full day, you got 2 hours at the end and they've done the smallmouth thing and don't want to pick up the pike stuff. We do have a lot of pike. So I think I'd say pike would be the next most common target we run into a lot out here. So that's a streamer fishing. That's your big swim baits, your big topwater, things like that. So pike are there. I have run-ins with muskie. I don't do trips for muskie because I'm not confident in the muskie enough yet for me to want to do that to somebody.
Yeah.
But you run into a lot. Seems like the population of them, as you go further north on the river, I think you get a little bit more, but kind of where I am, there's not a ton of them in the water that I fish, but it seems like there's getting to be more. I don't know if that's just a reflection of just there's more bait now and you're seeing them more. So we don't get any giant ones in my stretch, and I'm not targeting the giant ones, but you'll see them like, you know, mid 30s range. So smaller end for muskie for sure. But the interactions you get with those are always pretty dramatic. They're either, you know, the first day we fished this year, we had one crush a smallmouth streamer and almost hit its head on the boat. It ate so close to the rod tip. So you have stuff like that. And we had quite a few times this year, and you catch some like crappies in there too. And three or four times this year, you're reeling in a little bass or a crappie or something like that. Muskie will just come up and just T-bone it.
Oh, man.
So, I mean, you see that a lot. We get walleyes from time to time. There's quite a few walleyes in there, especially kind of in the cooler months. Once it gets real hot up here, you don't seem to see those as often, but they're around. The other one that's really cool here is we have I'll call it a fishery forum just because I think I've put in a lot of time and figured some stuff out, but we have a lot of kind of the native fish up here. We have all the suckers. Everyone's probably familiar with a lot of the Minnesota. We get a lot of the, I don't know the exact number, but we get a lot of the red horse species and all the sucker species. We have a ton of those. We have like the largest suckers too in the United States. We have a really good population of buffalo here. So our native sucker, you know, I have to do a little bit of my part of saying people, please don't kill them. They're not carp. So that's a really cool thing we have here that you hear a lot of people talk about seeing them and everyone talks about they're so spooky and they're so, but they're catchable here. And I've had a lot of people come out and do that. So there are ways that you can target them and have decent success, not smallmouth levels of success, but
yeah,
it's kind of like I've always kind of called them like the prairie permit for me.
I like that. Yeah, I'm gonna have to steal that one. Well, yeah. What's interesting, because I've seen your buffalo pictures now.
Yeah.
I've got experience with smallmouth buffalo, black buffalo. I've caught one bigmouth buffalo, but they seem much different. Like, it's smallmouth buffalo, like I feel like they're easier to catch. You know, there's more methods of catching them with baiting and what have you. Yeah. But the bigmouth buffalo have always been one of those weird ones for me, where it's like there's a lot of more mystery there, and I guess just downright difficulty there. But I've seen you with several photos holding bigmouth buffalo, so I'm like, I gotta ask him about that. I'm really interested in the smallmouth fishing.
Yeah, you know what I mean?
Because it's just such a fantastic like sport fish. It's just that classic is bronze brawler. I love smallmouth fishing. It's like a better version of bass fishing than not to hate on the green bass, but you know what I mean? I want to be in a river. I want to be working. I want to be reading the water, like you said. I want it. It's more, I don't know. I love smallmouth bass. I miss smallmouth bass. What's funny is I haven't caught a lot of smallmouth bass, and I mentioned this in another episode, but I've caught smallmouth bass in a lot of places.
I can help you fix that.
I need to make a Minnesota trip. I've talked to enough Minnesota guys that do awesome fishing. So there's a long list there. But yeah, I've caught smallmouths in Oklahoma, Arkansas. Now it doesn't sound like it's that many places.
You're talking Buffalo,
Missouri.
Right?
Smallmouth bass.
Okay.
In the lower mountain fork, I caught them in Oklahoma. And then I caught them in Arkansas and Missouri and South Carolina. I think that's it. Anyway, it's funny because I don't know much about smallmouth, but I've just managed to stumble across them in nearly a half a dozen states. But anyway, the buffalo thing, when I saw that, I'm like, I got to figure that out, because even the guys that have caught quite a few bigmouth buffalo, it just doesn't seem like they have reliable methods, like tried and true. So I was curious if you've, you know, I don't want you to give away any trade secrets, but how have you caught them? Because that is a species that will drive you crazy.
It is. And I don't want to give the wrong impression so I can go out and catch 50 of them in a day, but definitely, I can get them fairly consistently up here. I've not figured out a great way to do it for spinning rod stuff yet, but I do pretty decently well with it for the fly fishing side of it. So I think it's a lot to do. Again, we've talked about, you know, what makes this river a little bit different. We have just so many bugs in this river, and I think that's a really big part of why the buffalo here seem to be more conducive to fly angling, I'll call it. So it's a lot of the same stuff. So we've talked about everything's current based. So we have here, it's a big river. We have a lot of current. We have a lot of structure. Current makes bubbles, and I don't want to steal the trout thing here, but the foam around there tends to be a pretty good idea for where these buffalo tend to hang up, and that's, I've talked to people and I see that pretty similar, explanations for people. I see them in a lot of different areas. What I've noticed with ours is they group up in these big groups of them. So when I'm targeting them, I've never just fished to one fish. Obviously, once you find the one you're targeting, you're going to cast at that fish. But I've never went down and said, oh, there's one. It's always, oh, there's 30.
Yeah.
That's how it works up here. And I think that's a pretty common thing for other fisheries. When they tend to see them, they see a lot of them. So I'll call my program for it. It's all dry flies or terrestrials, you know, pick your word for it. So what I like to just do for them is find those groups. I always call it scum lines. So what I think's happening here is we get so many bugs. We talked about the damselflies earlier for a little bit. We talked about the dragonflies earlier for a little bit, but we have these just massive caddis hatches that are, you can barely see through them some days.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a single bass eat one. So it's just this huge forage base, and you just don't see the bass rise into it. And what I've noticed happens is, maybe this is like the entomology thing, or maybe it's just observant thing. A lot of those caddis get stuck in those big scum lines, and those big bubble lines, or thicker scum. Those buffaloes will load up in there. So I'll show the fly too. I know it's a podcast, but I know you do the YouTube thing too. So we use that. It's the same smallmouth fly. It's the Mr. Wiggly fly.
Okay.
That's every picture you see on my Instagram, every post, it's that fly. Same color, same size, same everything. It's that one.
Okay.
So these blue Wigglies, I think it could go with the damselfly. I also think it just doesn't really matter a whole lot of selection to it. But I have noticed, and it's the same thing, if you talk to anybody that carp fishes or permit fishes, I've never tried that before, but I've done a lot of carp up here and everywhere else I've lived. It seems like presentation is everything, but in almost a different way. I heard a stat from the guy up in Detroit Lakes area, something about the brain size to fish is the highest ratio in buffalo that is to anything else.
So I did not know that. I know that they live longer than any other freshwater fish, but I didn't realize that.
Super long lived, and I think that might not be true, but I think it is. We'll go with it if it's not. They're so smart, and like you said, they're selective. And what I've found is if you like directly cast at one, so how I've done it with a lot of people before and how I do it personally, where it's usually anchored up, so we'll see them. They give themselves away. They're huge, as you saw in some of the pictures. They're not very small. So you can see the mouths open up to look like little beach balls.
Yeah.
Kind of jumping across the top of the water. So I'll anchor up as far as your person feels confident with casting, or I feel confident with casting. The further you can get away from, obviously, the better. And I'll sit there for maybe 10 minutes or so. If you cast on them as soon as you see them, you're done. From what I've noticed. So it's a lot of, you know, observing and watching kind of the patterns. It's not dissimilar from trout, from what I've seen. They'll tend to, I call it like they circulate almost and all those things. They'll tend to make a circle, and you'll see the little parade of mouths doing that same pattern over and over again. So what I'll try to do is kind of read that, put the fly well ahead of them. So if they're on one half of the revolution they're making, I'll put my fly on the other half. So almost from what I've noticed, if they're in an area and you hit them pretty close to the face, I don't know if it's something about they can, it's almost like they watch for a change. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's my theory on them. When they eat, their eyes usually come up the way their eyes are aligned with their mouth. So it's almost like they almost take a little picture when they come up. And when they come back up, if something else is different, they're back down again. So they need to be able to make that line. They need to be able to make that circulation through. And whatever they're going to eat needs to already be there.
Okay. And now, the only thing I'm not picking up on, is this like subsurface, or are you talking about when they're clooping at the surface, like where the mouth's kind of doing that thing?
Yeah, all surface feeding. Yeah.
Okay.
Everything's up. And I've caught them too, like, you know, tailing carp fishing, but 90% of the ones I've got have been on the topwater. And that's a really common thing up here. We see that pretty much every day up here. So I mean, that's how I've been successful doing it is almost, it's a lot more anticipation than I think most people may be doing with it. I'll put it in there, and your cast may sit there for a minute or two. I'm just kind of keeping that bug in the spot they're likely going to be. And if that's the case, usually the lead fish will come up and start the train, and your bug's already been there, so it doesn't look foreign to them. At least that's my theory on it. I mean, that's how I found to be successful with it.
That's really consistent with some of the other accounts I've heard of guys that fish in Minnesota for big mouths. I think one guy, this guy Tyler Winter, has fished for him a lot, and he uses like inflated, like air filled worms or something. But I think if I remember correctly, it was kind of similar. It was like your bait has to be like sort of naturally drifting along in the path that they're already feeding.
Yeah.
But it's even more impressive that it's a fly, because you know, at least a worm is like a living thing. It smells it smells real, but like, you know, it's just I don't know. It's almost like, I wonder if they're eating it or if it's just sort of like it falling into their mouth because it's like the line of fire. You know what I mean?
I think that's what it is. I think they come up and, you know, whatever line they're going to be on, it's full of bugs. So they're just going to eat that line. And if there happens to be a blue wiggly in it, it's going to get eaten the same as all the caddis on that line. So I think the filter feeding thing is that, but tilted up.
So when take the fly, are they taking it, or are you just like, what are you doing? Like, you know, strip setting or trout setting on them as soon as it goes in their mouth, or are they like taking it and, you know, because I would think they'd immediately like dispel it. And once they notice something weird was going on.
So from what I can see with them and my experience with it, whenever they eat the fly, they'll usually kind of, here's the fly. It's a podcast, so you can't see it, but you'll come up there and they'll grab it. And usually every time they'll kind of take that big gulp, they'll almost like turn their head down a little bit before they move up to the next one. That's usually what I do. But I don't strip set it. They're eating it up on top of the water. I can usually see them pretty well. It's the same deal. I don't know if you've had the chance to fish like carp on the cicadas or anything like that, but it's really hard to figure out when they've actually got it because, you know, they've got that mouth like that. So you got to give them a little bit. And then I found the best success to just like the trout set on them, like just like you would with a dry fly.
Yeah.
It's what it is, just sized up by 30 pounds. So it's same strategies as, you know, dry fly fishing for trout, kind of finding the lies that they're going to be in. It's just a lot more anticipation, I guess. And that'd be my biggest tip for people wanting to try it, I guess, is they need to find it. It can't be, you can't find it for them. Basically, it's got to be there. I tell people it's the same thing with bass too, but it's got to be their idea. Is how I've kind of summed it up for people. And it's like you said, it's pretty addicting. And you know, they're spooky too. I mean, some days they'll feel the boat more than others, and they'll spook from 30 yards away. I mean, that happens sometimes, but it seems to happen less up here. When I was in school in Iowa, we had a ton of buffalo in Iowa, and those were tougher. Those didn't seem to be as, you know, conducive to the fly fishing angle. I mean, we caught a lot there down below, and it seems like the two stories you hear talking about buffalo, it's either they're super hard to catch and you got to get them plooping, or they're below a dam and they're eating like chunks of shad that get washed through. That was how we caught them in Iowa. We caught them on paddle tails.
That's the thing with those, with big mouth buffalo especially. Mm-hmm. I feel like they're one of the most curious cases of all fish in America. Yeah. One, because they get so enormous. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about a fish that get a native species that gets colossal, gigantic. Yeah. But I've seen the same thing. I see these photos of people where there's like a crankbait hanging out of its mouth. I'm like, is that legit? Or are they because, you know, then you see these other accounts where they're in rivers and that you can't get them to eat anything, worms, insects, baits. So it's,
it's legit. Yeah. There's a spillway. I think a lot of that stuff is, you know, dam related, but we added quite a few of them, like central Iowa where I was in school at, that we would go and do it. And I mean, you would catch them on, they'd school up below these dams. And as soon as the water starts coming through, I mean, it looks like, I don't want to say it looks like stripers on the coast or anything, but they're flashing through there.
And yeah. I mean,
they look active. They don't look like they're the kind of clunky feeders that, you know, we tend to think of them as, but yeah, I mean, we caught them on, you know, donker flies. We caught them on changers. We caught them on.
I feel like tails. When food is like nutrient rich enough, or like protein rich enough, or like abundant enough, like most fish will break the rules. I tell this all the time to people. There was this dam that I used to fish in South Carolina where every single July, always in July, I don't know what would cause it. This very specific dam, and it was some of the funnest fishing I've ever done anywhere. But we called it the clam hatch. There would be this weird release where hundreds of thousands of freshwater clams were like, they're just opening. I don't know what caused it, but the gas-filled corpses were coming up and floating down river. And you could catch everything that lived in that river. You could catch striped mullet on rod and reel. You could catch grass carp, gar, striped bass, largemouth bass, bowfin. Everything that lived in there was eating them. And it was like chaos out there. And all you had to do was just wade down river and pick these little clams up, stick them in a little bag, and just single hook it and send it down the line. It was any man's guess what you were going to catch, but it was like, you know, does a striped mullet ordinarily eat this? Does a striped bass ordinarily eat this? It was a really weird,
I had that same thing. We had the river I grew up in Tennessee. I had that in a July and I only saw it once, but yeah, it was like that. I showed up one day and the whole river smelled, and it was those eddy lines of those muscle innards or whatever the proper term for that is.
Yeah.
Were floating everywhere. Like you said, anything ate it. And for our case, anything ate anything you threw. I mean, we had 3 days there, and it was 100 fish a day on that clam die off or whatever you want to call it. And it was, we caught them on
the clam hatch.
Yeah. The clam hatch. People should look into that more.
It was weird. I wrote about it long, long time ago. And then like the blog is gone. I somehow got disappeared off the internet, but like, gosh, it was interesting. I used to like really catching the striped mullet was my favorite, because it's like, you know, you don't think of catching mullet on rod and reel. Yeah. But there'd be these massive schools, and like it was just such a fun river because the water was so clear. You just see these enormous schools of mullet, and like, you know, you could just watch the clam drift down towards them, and then they just blast it. So it was like, it was like as close to surefire guaranteed like catches as you could get. Like the these big like 30-pound grass carp would be up in there, and these big like marauding schools just waiting on clam to come down. I don't know what caused it though. But like the whole like floor of the river too, like when you're wading or whatever, it's just pure like mountains of. I mean, you could just open like you just pick up just empty shells. And I don't know. I had like a theory, like, you know, it was just weird that it was always in like around July. I was like, maybe that's just like the hottest time of year. I don't know if like.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was bizarre. It was like this. They stink to high hell.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's like this. It's like literally just a rotten corpse of a clam that's filled with gas and float down river. But yeah, it was weird. But that sheer abundance of easy food source, it seemed like it made all the fish in the river, you know, just play by a different set of rules than they ordinarily would. So
yeah,
really interesting. Yeah, man, the bigmouth buffaloes, that is one of the most curious cases of fish in our entire country. So when it's I saw your pictures, I was like, man, I got to know what he does to get them. But
yeah, I've never got them up here on spinning stuff, but that's the dry fly thing is pretty consistent for him, I would say.
Yeah. Well, anytime I get guys on here that do guiding, I never like to get too caught up on like your guide program, because it's like a lot of guys, like you have the guiding, but then you have like your time, because I know that like it before anything else, you yourself are an angler. So like, what is your fishing? You know what I mean? You got like, you probably got your guide season, but like, you know, is your personal fishing pretty in line with the stuff that you do guiding wise, or are you doing like totally different stuff? I've seen you with the lake sturgeon, which I, you know, we can touch on, because that is, I've mentioned enough times on this podcast, like that, as far as like the North American landscape of freshwater fish, it's like, it's got to be in the top three. It's like in there. Top five seems to interchange with me a lot, but like the lake sturgeon is a real big one for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an awesome fish. Yeah. I'll talk about that in a second. But yeah, I think for the most part, I'm really, really set on rivers. We have, you know, land of 40 billion lakes here, and I take the river that I'm close to over any of the lakes. I grew up river fishing. That's like where my passion is. But I mean, I do a lot of smallmouth fishing in my free time. I have, you know, a lot of friends from down in Iowa that come up and we do a lot of smallmouth fishing. So that's the majority of the time I'm doing that. I really like the pretty big sucker for like the big bluegills too. We have a bunch of lakes around here that get some real big like hybrid bluegills. So I do a lot of panfish fishing like on my own too, when not guiding stuff. And then I really like the oddball stuff. I spend a lot of time in like the urban parts of Minneapolis. I guess there's a really good carp fishery kind of downtown. So I do a lot of the carp chasing in my own time, I guess. When I'm not bass fishing, I do a lot of carp. Sturgeon thing is I grew up in the South where we don't have them. I moved to Iowa, who also doesn't really have that many. They may have a few, and then came up here and kind of got access to them, I'll call it. So my wife grew up in the Milwaukee area. That's where she's from. And one of her family friends, who's now become my really good friend, took me on the Wolf River in Wisconsin for the first time and showed me the first sturgeon. And that was that started something that I don't think anyone was prepared for, of how much I ended up loving those fish. So we fished them for Wisconsin quite a bit, kind of early in the year too. And then that the big one with Justin too. You know, Wisconsin has a certain seasons you can do it. So obviously be aware of when you're doing it. But fishing with Justin this year was great. Those big ones were with him. So we did a lot of there. That's also in Wisconsin. But the whole native thing is really cool, and the whole ancient fish to me is really cool. I know you're big into the bowfin. That's on my list for this year. I've caught them on Okeechobee a ton before, where they always just called them gator bait down there. But that's something I want to get more into this year. But yeah, man, the sturgeon. That fight is something I was not prepared for. I mean, obviously they're big, but you know, seeing the jumps and things like that. And I was talking with Justin a few days ago. We're gonna try to put a trip together this fall and try to get a couple on the fly. He's done it before.
Now that's nuts.
We're gonna try.
I think he might have told me that on the podcast. It's like, that's so outside the box. I love it when people do something that's just different, but you just, you just don't think of that on as being a fly.
Yeah.
Well, not fly worthy, but like a fly doable fish.
Yeah. The fights on those things. I mean, you see the video that all of us grew up on River Monsters. If you're this, everyone grew up watching. You see the jumps and stuff when he's fighting those things. You almost don't believe it until you see it for yourself. I think that the biggest one we got with Justin this year, we got one that was 63 inches or something like that, and straight out of the water. So as soon as I put the hook to that one, just every bit of that fish is flying through the air 3 or 4 times, and it beats everything you ever saw of it. That's something I couldn't believe that. And the runs and the bulldogs, and you know, it's a really cool thing when you grew up fishing for bass and trout and everything to catch a fish you have to get in the water with for your safety and its. That's just, it's such a cool thing. And the whole native and like all the conservation status around those and kind of how Wisconsin's been able to bring those fish back like they have. It's such a cool story. And it's the community aspect of it. Just the sturgeon scene in Wisconsin is really cool to me. And, you know, getting to know those people that do it, it's a cool thing. And I'm looking forward to September again. That's the time of year you can target them in Wisconsin. So that's when I do most of it is September. I mean, you see them bycatch in Wisconsin early in the year, but for targeting, you got to use the season, obviously. But that's a really good one. That's a really fun fish. That's been my, I guess it's not exotic to call it that, but kind of the out of my everyday fishing is what I've really enjoyed this year, was doing that and chasing the carp. And we do, you know, personally stuff. I'll try to dial in the buffalo thing for a while too and get that figured out. So
yeah,
the bass are definitely my most things. And my wife does it with me too. She's starting to get, she caught her first smallmouth last year with me on the river. So I've gotten her into it now a little bit more. So that's always cool to share that with her. So that'd be my answer, I guess. I rambled a little bit there, but a lot of bass and then kind of mixture of all the natives too, though. all those too have been a really good time. And we're really looking forward to this year with this big cicada thing coming. So hopefully that'll be that's something we're hoping to do a little bit of this year.
That's like a weird thing. That is like a type of fishing I'm not familiar with at all, but I see the posts every year, and incredible. I don't know if it's in your area or if it's an East Coast thing, but like I see these posts every year where they like everybody's predicting this, and they have like a weird name for it, like, oh, this is the CH35 hatch. I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, there's like these mega hatches.
The fun entomologist part of it. Yeah,
it's a weird thing to like forecast and then like formulate your whole like program of fishing around. There's just so many different unique styles of fishing to experience, like not enough time to do it. I feel like that lake sturgeon will probably be my reason for coming up around y'all's neck of the woods. I'm thinking like I'm on this like this big thing about trying to do these like international trips right now, but like I feel like next year is going to be more like my North American tour.
Yeah.
So maybe I feel like I could squeeze it in this year, but more likely 2025. I need a muskie. I need a lake sturgeon. There's a few salmonids that I need to check off.
That's a fun thing up here too. We get I think we're about the only place that's not Alaska that's consistent enough to catch them. We get a really good run of pink salmon in Minnesota.
Okay.
Out of Superior. And I think most people have to go to Alaska. Obviously, Canada's got them because it's got Superior too. But we get some tributaries to Lake Superior up around, like, you know, Duluth, like northern Minnesota. They get a really good run.
Now, y'all don't have that weird thing where everybody's standing shoulder to shoulder and everybody's in the water all on top of each other. Those images. I'm like, I think I'd rather go to my grave without ever catching the fish if that's what I had to do.
So that is something that I get it 100%. Maybe it's just my like thing with that. I like seeing the different things, but I do that once a year. We go to, you know, the Milwaukee area.
Is it for eating them? What is the, that's the thing. Everybody that does it, like there's a culture behind it. That's like, it's more about appreciating that like niche experience than being like,
There's just a little part of me, and it dies quickly every year. But there's a little part of me that just wants to see that, just once a year. Because here, you know, we have a lot of there's so many options. You don't see that many people. And it's just kind of funny to watch how much of a mess it can be. And all the, just the, it's gotta be a game warden's, you know, it's gotta be a game warden's dream to work one of those spots and just see the snag hook comes out. And like you said, shoulder to shoulder with everybody. And it's, if you haven't seen it, I'd recommend seeing it once. It's a cool thing.
Always stay open-minded to trying new things. That one's really not, you know, there's some other stuff that, like, I've also been talking about, like, I want a paddlefish, but then I'm like, I just struggle with the snagging part. But it's then it's tough. Like, okay, so then the alternative is just never, ever see a paddlefish. I don't know where I stand on that one. I think I'd probably be pretty open to try. It's fun to talk crap about that style of fishing where they all stand like that in the river, but it's not to say I wouldn't do it. I have been to some shad spots during like the shad runs we have here on the East Coast where you're basically doing the same thing. I've done some shad fishing in South Carolina where it was like the boats are basically tethered together.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right on each other and you're just catching shad. And it was like same things. Like I look forward to it all year long to do the shad run. And then you go out there once or twice. I'm done with this. I can't do it anymore.
Shad's on my list. I know that's such like a regional thing, but I think that's a really cool one. I've not done that one yet. That's shad's one I need to get.
Yeah, if you're the type of person that's genuinely interested in fish and just biology and like fish behaviors and like when you really learn like how special their migration is, it's like, you know, it goes beyond just hey, here's a fish you catch. Like when you understand, you know, the historical relevance of shad runs that like literally shaped the country and kept its founders alive through like winters and stuff. It's unique. But me, I just did it to stock up on bowfin bait. So
I've heard that's a pretty killer bait for them.
Oh yeah. Well, they're oily. It's a great bait fish, but they're like little tarpon. That's what everybody says. And I mean, they jump, they go crazy. Yeah. They're phenomenal fighters. And it's kind of the same thing as a river fish. They spend their whole life swimming and migrating and they're just like athletes. But yeah, man, that's an awesome one. I love the Minnesota fishery. I know, like, you know, as far as like multi-species people or people who appreciate other types of fish, it just Minnesota has been like the spawning ground for people of that character type.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sure that y'all have the throw them on the bank crowd too, but like Minnesota's has got a lot of great players in the game that are leading the charge, even on a national level to get attention around some of these fish. But
I mean, there's definitely spots like that, but yeah, I mean, for the most part, it's a very, and I'll call it like open-minded community, I guess, of the different fisheries we have here. I mean, it's, you can go to a place and see five or six guys purposely fishing for sucker. And I don't know that that's a thing many other areas. I mean, it gets talked about up here for all the different sucker fisheries we have. And it's just crazy the diversity you have up here in the choices you can make. And I mean, like you said, you come up here for 2 weeks and probably fish for something different every day and probably pretty successful at it each time. So it's such a great place just for anyone that's in, especially the warm water thing. And, you know, we wouldn't even mention trout, but you know, trout's a pretty big thing up here too. But you know, there's where I live personally, we're like 30 minutes from the Wisconsin line. So we can be to the driftless portion of Wisconsin, like 30 minutes, and the driftless portion of Minnesota and about 2 hours or so from where I am. So we have some really good trout fisheries in the area too that a lot of people come up for that want to come to Minnesota and kind of do the whole thing. Like I have people that'll do, they'll come up and trout fish a day and then float for smallmouth the next day. So that's a pretty common one up here just because you have so much variety and such quality fisheries of all of it. So it's really cool spot to, you know, for people that are interested in that. You know, everyone seems like multi-species has gained so much traction in the, even since I've been fishing, I'm 29 now. And even when I was in high school, I don't think I remember seeing that much. You know, bass was kind of the king and you didn't see many people talk about anything else. It's cool to see. I mean, obviously like the Meat Eater article that just came out. Saw familiar, few familiar faces in that
it
one.
Is, yeah. Cool it, there has it. Been a massive, massive transition in the perception that I've seen. At least, I don't know. For I always go back and forth. I wonder, and at least the warm and fuzzy feeling is that everybody's effort to like put them on the map has created this change in perception. But then the other part of me is like, well, maybe it was always there, but like now you can actually see it since social media and internet and stuff is revealing it all. But I mean, man, it's interesting. It's good times. I think people are just hungrier more now than ever before for like going and doing something different. So some of those other species provide that, but I don't want to end this podcast without asking things that have nothing to do with fishing because
for sure.
The mosquito thing.
yeah. Let's get back to it. This is fun.
All right. You're on record and maybe the FBI is listening.
Oh man.
Are they putting vaccines and things into robotic tiny mosquitoes and sending them out to sting people and inject them with unknown substances?
So they don't sting, so it's all biting. If we're going for stinging, we're worse. But
are there tiny robotic spy mosquitoes out there planted by the government?
I am pretty confident in saying no with that one. I have not ran into that issue yet. You'll be the first one that hears about it if it is, though.
Right.
No, I have not heard that one. They don't have cameras in their eyes either.
Yeah.
Just some of the things. That's not fish related, you said it's even better. Some of the when people learn that you're an entomologist, the things that you get, your text messaging groups look quite different once someone knows what you do.
Yeah.
Of all the what bit me, you get a lot of pictures of is this a spider bite? A lot of what bit me here, is this a bed bug?
My brother is one of my older brothers is a dermatologist. So yeah, that's about 99% of his life is photos of nasty bites and photos of nasty growths on their skin. Is this?
Yeah. Entomology is cool because you get these like big phases of things that happen, and like the cicada thing is like my perfection to me. It's a warm water fishery, like targeted for the most part. It's huge amounts of really cool, really crazy life history bugs. So it's about as good as it gets for me.
Are you knowing what mosquitoes are capable of? Are you more more afraid of when they bite you, or is it? Are you more like this is no big deal if they get you?
I think definitely area makes a difference. I mean some of the areas that have a lot more access to things that could be bad are obviously an issue, but it's not something that let bother me, I guess. It's not something that would ever dissuade me from doing fishing. So.
Yeah, like the South Florida mosquitoes that have crack cocaine in their blood because of all the crackheads they've been feeding on. You might come down here and get some Florida man blood put in you.
Yeah, I guarantee it. Yeah, folks got some wild stuff going on down there.
And they're feeding on an iguana 1 second and then feeding on you the next. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a little different than ours up here. But yeah, it's a cool field. You get to deal with a lot of really, I'll call it interesting questions. And you work with the public a lot of how, things are perceived of what's going on out there. And
will we ever be able to pull dinosaur DNA out of a mosquito that's stuck in an amber stone, like in Jurassic Park?
Not out of that kind that they had in there for sure. But
that was not a correct mosquito that was represented. Not a correct.
So yeah, only the... Only the females can bite you, and the one in that one, if you look at it, don't think that was the case. But
see,
so there's a lot of things that people that looked really cool though, right? So Spielberg,
are you
was
that
all
guy
about it.
During the movie that goes, actually,
I can't be that guy, but if someone talks about it, I have to bring it up. But no, it's still really cool to me. That I think that movie is probably a lot of why I ended up on the science train anyway. But. I watched that thing and read the book so much when I was younger. So I probably have that movie to blame for a lot of where I ended up. But
I'm all for bringing back the dinosaurs and bringing back Woolly Man.
Oh, for sure. Let's go.
Anyway. Well, man, how can people find you? Let's say maybe somebody's listening is like, man, I live up there. I want to come up there and fish with him for smallmouth. How can you be reached? Your Instagram, your whatever kind of pages. How can they find you?
Yeah, so I've got Instagram. That's probably the one that most people reach out to. It's where the coolest pictures are. It seems to be that draws people. So Instagram is at Regal Beagle Fly Fishing. Just type that in. You'll find me. Same thing on the Facebook page. Regal Beagle Fly Fishing there again. My website too, if you just Google Regal Beagle Fly Fishing, the website comes up through Google there. So those are the three main ones I use. Pretty responsive on all of them. So if anyone, pretty much any route you can get me, find my phone number and everything on there, give me a call, book a trip. That's something you're into if you're just into the fly side. I do have some flies on the website for the fly sales portion of it, but tends to be the deal with all the smaller tires. I just kind of take a lot of custom orders. If people call me and say they want so-and-so, I can do it. So just because it's not on the website doesn't mean it's not there. So I get a lot of people orders. I'm going to Montana in 6 weeks. Can you hook me up for that? And I do a lot of stuff like that. So I mean, the fly portion of it's a big thing for me too, but that's under all the same Instagram, Facebook, website, just Regal Beagle Fly Fishing, and fly fishing and spin trips. So if you're not a fly fisherman, that's perfectly cool with me. We do a lot of both. So yeah, that's the contact. So Regal Beagle Fly Fishing anywhere.
Regal Beagle Fly Fishing. I'll be sure to put that up on the screen and down in the description for anybody who wants to see more. But Caleb, man, I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be a part of it. I really like your show. Really like listening to it. And honored to be a guest on it. So thank you so much for the invite.
Yeah, dude. Appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening to Boundless Pursuit. Tune in each week as we bring stories and insight from uniquely talented anglers and outdoorsmen. And if you enjoyed this show, I want to hear from you. Be sure to leave a 5-star review, as this is going to drive the growth and exposure of this show. And if you have feedback or guest suggestions, I would love to hear from you. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com. For all other collections of media and contact information, please visit www.boundless-pursuit.com.